We'll hear arguments next in the matter of Edna Smith, its appellant, 7756. McLean, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm Ray McLean of Charleston, South Carolina. I represent Edna Smith of Columbia, South Carolina, a member of the bar of this Court who is seated to my left this morning. Ms. Smith is before this Court seeking reversal of professional disciplinary punishment imposed on her for advising one Marietta Williams that the services of the American Civil Liberties Union were definitely available to Mrs. Williams, with whom she had previously consulted. Ms. Williams was a welfare recipient in Aiken, a small community in South Carolina, and Ms. Williams had been sterilized in early July 1973 as a condition of her receiving treatment as a Medicaid patient by a physician in Aiken. This case presents important questions both under the First Amendment and the Due Process Clause. The Due Process Clause, particularly as to the vagueness of the rules prior to their construction by the, in fact, as construed by the Court below. I shall limit my comments here to those issues relating to various aspects of the First Amendment concerns and rely on the briefs as to other due process matters unless the Court has specific questions. It's our position that this case is squarely controlled by this Court's opinion in NAACP versus Button, a decision in which the organizational activities of the American Civil Liberties Union were expressly referred to and referred to with approval. And that decision, as it has been amplified in the cases of Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen versus Virginia, United Mine Workers versus Illinois, and United Transportation Union versus Michigan. The force of those cases, we submit, has been augmented also by this Court's decision last term in Bates versus the State Bar of Arizona, where the Court extended the application of these prior associational cases to protect advertising of the availability and price of legal services. Based on these prior decisions,
would you suggest that the right to solicit face-to-face solicitation is coextensive with the right to advertise and announce the fees which will be charged for a particular service?
Certainly not coextensive, but to the extent that the same interests of providing information for informed decision-making by the person to whom the information is directed, First Amendment concerns are equally relevant. The balancing of interests may be different.
Well, a solicitor, do you suggest that a face-to-face solicitation by a trained lawyer on the one hand and the untrained layman, untrained at least in the law, presents the same kind of arm's-length factors as an announcement in the paper of a schedule of fees?
Well, in the first place, I think I should point out that in this case, the conduct which is alleged to be solicitation, the letter which was written by Ms. Smith, was not a face-to-face confrontation of that sort.
I was beginning right by relating it to the case which we just heard argued.
Right. And with respect to the, I think that clearly any time there is a face-to-face confrontation, there are other factors operating that are not operating in a written communication.
Do you think the written letter is equated roughly to the announcement in the newspaper?
I think it's closer to that, certainly, than an in-person solicitation. The scope of the First Amendment protection, as we read the Button case and the succeeding cases, is that it protects associational activity to initiate litigation, to support litigation, insofar as such litigation may further legitimate goals of the organization by assuring meaningful access to the courts. And that meaningful access does not depend on whether or not the persons who are being informed of their rights are members of the association or not. They were not in the Button case. Obviously, the information disseminated in the Bates case was not disseminated to any particular limited associational group. And further, that attorneys may participate in such organizational and associational activities with a similar First Amendment constitutional protection. Indeed, the parallels that this case presents with the Button case are very striking. A very important activity of the NAACP in Button was providing legal services. The court said it had an extensive program of providing legal services to aggrieved parties in certain types of cases. That's similar to the situation here. The NAACP limited the scope at the outset of its undertaking representation of anyone, but thereafter exercised no control over the actual conduct of the litigation. The ACLU follows a similar practice. In Button, attorneys really rather aggressively solicited parties who, according to the opinion in the Virginia Supreme Court, had never expressed any interest in litigating, had no idea they would be met by an attorney when they went to various community meetings, and yet attorneys were there participating in the attempt to persuade people at these meetings to join lawsuits, to attack practices of segregation, and those attorneys in the litigation that followed were compensated, something which was not the case with respect to ACLU attorneys. The matter here, as in Button, was a suit attacking government practices, in this case the provision of Medicaid services.
In this case, Mr. McLean, though, your client pursued a little more aggressively than in Button, didn't she? I mean, wasn't she present at the initial meeting and then was told that if the client wished to employer services, the client would let her know, and then nonetheless your client followed up with a kind of a second solicitation?
The record does not really reflect that, Your Honor. The only thing that's clearly reflected by the record is that one Gary Allen, who had organized the meeting, was, according to Ms. Williams' testimony, advised that she would call if Ms. Williams wanted further assistance. The record is not clear that Ms. Smith was ever told that. The Attorney General at the hearing never asked Ms. Smith whether she had told
that. The record is clear, though, that your client did make a second attempt to persuade the litigant to file a suit.
I don't agree with that characterization of the letter, Your Honor. I believe that the record is clear that Ms. Smith wrote a letter. I do not believe that it can fairly be characterized as an attempt to persuade her, and in her testimony she explicitly stated that she was not trying to persuade anyone. In fact, Ms. Williams testified. The only evidence that Ms. Williams, the person allegedly solicited, had on the question of a persuasion was that Edna Smith had not attempted to persuade or pressure her in any way to file a lawsuit.
Well, putting to one side the characterization of the letter, which may be subject to reasonable interpretations on both sides, that follow-up letter is a fact that wasn't present in Button, isn't it?
To my knowledge, in fact, there were that was actually probably one of the problems in Button, that many of the people who signed retainer agreements did not even know that lawsuits were going to be filed until after they read about them in the newspaper.
Well, was there or were there not evidence of follow-up letters in Button?
To my knowledge, I know of none.
Well, now, I'm not sure whether your colloquy with Mr. Justice Rehnquist refers to the letter, which I thought was the only letter. Let me read part of it and see. She wrote and said, "You will probably remember me from talking with you at Mr. Allen's office in July about the sterilization performed on you. The American Civil Liberties Union would like to file a lawsuit on your behalf for money against the doctor." Is that the letter we're talking about?
That is the letter that we're talking about, Your Honor. The letter goes on to state, in addition, that the in the next paragraph, in fact, there in the next sentence, she said, "We will be coming to Aiken in the near future and would like to explain what is involved." This is on page 9 of the state's brief, so you can understand what is going on. The next paragraph proposes a magazine interview if Ms. Williams is interested in publicizing the issue of forced sterilizations, which Ms. Smith makes quite clear is totally up to Ms. Williams whether she would participate in that practice or not, in that interview or not, and asks in the last paragraph about the lawsuit, "If you are interested, let me know." There's really no persuasive content to this letter. And in fact, as it was characterized by Ms. Smith in her testimony before the hearing panel, this letter was essentially an attempt to advise Ms. Smith, advise Mrs. Williams that the ACLU would in fact give Ms. Williams assistance if she wanted it. We have to take into consideration, Your Honor, the fact that the Ms. Williams was relatively uneducated, that Ms. Smith had perceived her as not being very well informed about her rights, not understanding the initial conversation very well. And this was simply a letter in which there was an attempt made to be sure Ms. Williams had considered the matter fully before she decided what she was going to do. Ms. Williams shortly thereafter called Ms. Smith, said, "I'm not interested in bringing a lawsuit," and that was the end of it. Ms. Williams never made any complaint to any agency that she had been pressured by Ms. Smith, or never complained in any way about Ms. Smith's conduct.
Mr. McClain, would the theory of your case be different if your client had been an ACLU lawyer who would have tried the case had the solicitation been successful?
I don't believe that there is a distinction in the Button case. That's what happened in Button. People solicited clients and tried the cases and were paid for them, which ACLU cooperating attorneys were not.
And you stand on Button on that particular point?
Well, I think that this case is less
right.
extreme than Button.
Yes. Carry it one step farther, assume further that the ACLU lawyer, contrary to its practice, allowed counsel who handled damage suits, which would have been this suit, a percentage recovery as a fee, a percentage of the recovery as a fee. Would that make this commercial speech rather than non-commercial speech?
I believe, Your Honor, that the distinction between commercial and non-commercial speech is a much more narrow one. That Your Honor's opinion in the Pittsburgh Press case, for example, appears to characterize commercial speech as only that speech which has no other purpose but commercial.
So even if there were an interest, a fee interest in the damage recovery, you would not regard that as commercial speech?
I don't believe that makes it commercial speech, and that's true in the that's been true in the pornography and obscenity area. That's been true in the in many cases before this court. That there is a financial element does not make the speech per se commercial, and as I read the opinions.
Then what does make it commercial?
If the only purpose is commercial, as in the case that was just argued before ours,
so
then
if
it's commercial
speech.
So if
a drugstore had a
a sale. If you bought one cake of soap, you could get a second cake free. That wouldn't be commercial for a second cake of soap?
I would certainly think that's commercial speech, Your Honor. There's
isn't any offering of goods or services at any price commercial in the general sense of the word as contrasted to the other kind of speech on social, economic, political, or religious, among others?
I think that it's that the offer of goods for benefit.
Goods or services.
Goods or services to the individual who is offering and for compensation. I don't think that the offer of free services, for example, would fairly be characterized as commercial. And in fact, I mean, that's the distinction that I believe Mr. Justice Powell was just pointing to, that were the client charged something for his the services he was receiving, would the client, would that make it commercial? I don't believe that it would, but that's certainly a different case from the situation that the ACLU has consistently practiced and that there's never been any change in and it's presented in this case.
Mr. McClain, I don't think that distinction will hold up. Supposing the letter were written to a stockholder and there was an offer to represent a class of stockholders to get a big recovery and a statement in the letter that we won't charge you a dime, it'll be free to you, would that be non-commercial solicitation?
Would the attorney in that case be looking to seek to get an award of fees from the defendant on some,
yes,
I guess, incorporation?
Sure.
But of course,
just like they were here, as in this case.
But I think it's really different because when you're looking to get compensation from the corporation in which the person holds stock,
let's say it's a class action, you know, instead of a derivative suit, then, but it's just one to get money, and it would the mere fact that that there would be no charge unless the litigation were successful make it not commercial speech? Is that your position? That's what I understood you to say.
No, sir, not unless it were successful. But just the fact that there would be no charge for the litigation, that was my position.
No charge to the person being solicited for the litigation. What about this case? It was contemplated that there would recover dollars and that those dollars would in part go into the coffers of the ACLU.
No, sir, not at the time the letter was written. I don't believe the record supports that.
Suit for damages. It was described as a suit for damages.
That's correct. A suit for money damages, but that all would go to the client. None of that go to the ACLU in any respect.
Well, don't we have to accept that the state court's view of the matter, that there it was contemplated that a fee would be paid to the ACLU, and that would be dollars?
That might be ordered by the court.
Yes. Just like the damages would be ordered by the court.
But in a different sense. But the important, or one important factor is that, for example, the record does not support any notion that Ms. Smith knew that the ACLU would ask for attorney's fees in connection with any litigation.
Don't think that's a reasonable inference?
Sir, I'm sorry.
What if she did? And what would that violate?
Well, I'm just making the point, Your Honor, that the record in this case does not reflect that Ms. Smith was acting in a fashion to get money for the ACLU.
Well, what if she were?
I think it's protected. I
mean,
agree.
She was charged with aiding an organization to promote her legal services or that of her associate. She wasn't charged with helping some organization raise some money.
Well, one of the things that the state court relied on was the possibility of financial benefit to the organization, making it a non-exempt organization. I did not find that persuasive, but that was relied on below.
But I had understood all of this colloquy was directed at whether this was commercial or non-commercial speech. At least I understood Mr. Justice Stevens' question to you was directed at that.
I believe that is the way it started out, Your Honor. And I think that brings me back to a point which I wanted to make, that the court found that as far as this case is concerned, the ACLU has only entered cases in which substantial civil liberties questions are involved. So that with respect to the ACLU's activities, we are dealing with a situation where even if some fees might be paid to them eventually, it's in the context of substantial civil liberties litigation.
When you say substantial civil liberties litigation, what do you mean? You mean a constitutional right?
That constitutional or possibly a statutory right protecting civil liberties.
How does one know the contours of that if you include within it statutory rights?
Well, for example, there are a number of statutes which are deemed to enforce provisions of the Bill of Rights or interests related to the Bill of Rights. Certain provisions of the Omnibus Crime Control Act involving electronic eavesdropping go after or aimed at the same interests that are protected by the Fourth Amendment.
What about a state statute that gives you a right of action against someone who deliberately runs you down in a car for personal damages? Is that is not a civil liberty statute?
No, sir. That's not.
What's the difference between that and a sterilization, which is a bad form of battery, I guess?
Well, the issue that was raised in the litigation, which the related litigation on behalf of other women who had been sterilized by this doctor, was whether or not that violated making that a condition of receipt of governmentally supported services, violated the Federal Civil Rights Act, 1983 and 85.
I was under the impression, maybe I have a wrong view of the record, that this doctor did these services free.
That's not correct.
He
was
compensated. He would do it if the patient would agree to this condition. Is that what it was?
But the patients were Medicaid patients.
Right.
And the doctor would accept them as Medicaid patients only if they would accept sterilization. If the patient were able to pay, he would not require sterilization after the third pregnancy. But that's what he would require with respect to Medicaid patients.
These were all maternity cases?
With respect to this doctor, that's correct.
They were Medicaid cases of pregnant women, and the expenses were in connection with the birth of their children. Is that it?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
And after the second or third, I guess it was the third child, he said, no, I won't be your physician anymore unless you agree to be sterilized.
That's my understanding of that record. I was not involved in that case myself. Mm-hmm. I'd simply like to emphasize that the state concedes that the first meeting at which Ms. Smith met with Ms. Williams was protected. And in its brief on page 30, it says it was protected to advise her of her legal rights, her legal remedies, and of the availability of the ACLU. We find it difficult to see why a letter to a person who Ms. Smith did not perceive to fully understand her rights, even after that conversation, a single letter is stripped of all constitutional protection once that first concession is made that the initial meeting was a protected meeting.
You don't claim that just because something's a letter, the writer of it can't be punished in all sorts of contexts. Blackmailing letters certainly can be punishable under the criminal law of any state constitutionally, can't it be?
That's correct, sir. But there would have to be some interest
demanding ransom or...
That's correct.
Just the fact it's a letter doesn't give it a free ticket constitutionally to go unscathed through all the criminal statutes, state and federal, in the United States, does it?
Just as speech, which is extortionate in nature, is not protected at all by the First Amendment.
But all sorts of speech isn't. Deceptive speech, fraudulent speech.
Agreed.
Blackmailing speech.
Agreed. No, we have no dispute with that.
That would be true also if a coded classified ad were put in the paper, in a newspaper, a legitimate newspaper, taking an ad which purported to be an ad for the sale of a house, but in fact was, by a prearranged code, a direction for how to pay the ransom in a kidnap. That wouldn't be protected, would it, just because it was in a newspaper?
I would hardly think so.
No.
Mr. McLean, you said you didn't see a difference between the oral meeting in July and the letter in August. But the oral meeting was advice on the merits, as I understand it, and the August letter was a solicitation after giving advice on the merits. There's at least a difference, isn't there?
Well, Your Honor, the only difference is advising the client, or prospective client, that the ACLU is definitely available to provide
counsel. Would like to bring an action on your behalf, and this practice must stop, and so forth. It was within the power of the court to treat that as a solicitation, I believe. Wouldn't you agree to that? You couldn't say such a finding is clearly erroneous.
Well, one of the problems, Your Honor, is that solicitation was never defined. So I'm not absolutely clear as to what was meant by solicitation. It was not the recommending of her own services, because she was not found guilty of 2103A.
But you do, don't you think it's fair to read that letter as recommending that she file a lawsuit?
I think it could be subject to that interpretation.
I would think so. This practice must stop, is what the letter says.
And that's an expression of an opinion about, and that's
by
a speech
the author
activity.
Of the letter to the person who's reading it.
It's a speech activity commenting on a issue of public interest.
Then toward the end of the letter, she said, call me after Labor Day, call me collect, and gave her telephone number.
That's correct.
Doesn't that support the concept of solicitation? Well, the finding?
You have to remember that the letter also said, if you are interested, let me know. It does invite further discussion.
By hypothesis, you wouldn't say in a letter, if you are not interested, let me know.
No, but it also did not say, please sign this letter in return by return mail, and we will represent you. It was an invitation for further discussions with respect to the conversation.
Could I ask you, what rule was she found to have violated?
Two, Your Honor. DR 2103D, which, as you commented earlier, involves promoting her activities, and 2104A5. Which
well,
I
that
have never
isn't
understood.
An that, is, you think that's an independent rule? Is that a prohibition? I thought it was just an exception to the...
That's been my understanding and my argument throughout this litigation, Your Honor, but the state court below did not accept that.
Where did the court not accept that?
I believe it refers on...
It just quotes the panel...
On page 1A of the jurisdictional statement, Your Honor.
And what's that?
It says she was found guilty of violating both these rules. That's the court opinion.
Well, but it goes on and says that the court adopts the panel report as an accurate.
That's certainly correct. Yes, sir.
Isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
And what's the final?
Both rules are referred to in the panel report, Your Honor. It's somewhat opaque to me, too. I think perhaps you should ask Mr. Cale exactly how that is related.
Because D5 doesn't independently proscribe any conduct, does it?
It's been my argument all along, Your Honor. I agree. But the court found otherwise.
And what conduct do you think it prescribes? That you may not solicit business for an organization if its primary purpose is to litigate? Is that the way it's been interpreted, you think, in this case?
I'm really not sure, Your Honor.
I suppose it can only be read as saying that her conduct, in the view of the court, didn't come within the exception of D5.
But she never accepted employment, which was the original.
Well, if it doesn't come within the exception, then what she violates is D.
Yes.
And that requires solicitation for her own benefit. It requires aiding an organization
to promote her services.
To promote her services.
That's the way I've been reading the rules all along, Your Honor.
Do you still argue, let me have this clear, that this letter does not constitute a solicitation?
I don't believe we concede. She did not agree to that, Your Honor.
Draw your attention to the last five lines. About the lawsuit, if you're interested, let me know, and I'll let you know when we will come down to talk to you about it. We will be coming down to talk to Mrs. Waters and so forth.
Certainly.
Having said call me collect and all these other preliminaries, do you still maintain that is not a soliciting letter?
Your Honor, I don't want to make a concession to that effect. I don't understand precisely what soliciting means in this context.
Let me put it in another way. You say that that letter is not an adequate basis for a finding by the fact finder that solicitation took place.
Your Honor, my understanding is that a disciplinary rule has to be violated. The only disciplinary rule that talks about what I would think of as solicitation is DR 2103A, which is the recommending of the employment of yourself or your associates, and 104A, which is the acceptance, the rules that are clearly involved in Mr. Oralik's case. Neither of those rules is involved in this case. And so it's hard for me to admit that this is a solicitation case. I'm not really sure exactly what the interpretation was.
Mr. McLean, before you sit down, I understand your argument on 104A. There was no acceptance of employment,
yes.
So that the language just doesn't seem to apply. I don't thoroughly understand your position on 103D5. I understand the exception part doesn't apply, but why doesn't the first sentence cover this transaction? One of the first sentence of D, a lawyer shall not knowingly assist a person or organization, your client shall not assist the ACLU, that recommends, furnishes, or pays for legal services to promote the use of his services or those of his partners or associates. Now, wasn't it clear that the associates of your client were involved in the litigation and one of them was paid by the ACLU?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to look at that in contrast with 2103A, which talks also about recommending the services of the partners and associates. And she was not found, although that was argued below, she was not found to have recommended those services. Now, I really don't...
But she assisted an organization that was using the services of those partners in the very matter.
She was using that what? Well, now that's correct. And it seems to me that that's exactly what the court said in Button.
Your answer to that is this is if it's covered by this, it's constitutionally protected. That's your main argument, not that it's not within the language.
That's certainly the principal argument.
Well,
yes.
Whether or not it's within or without the language is a matter of state law, isn't it? None of our concern, except insofar as it may go to show how vague and unconstitutionally broad, perhaps, in your submission, the language is.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But whether or not it's inside it or outside it is a matter for the state court to decide, and it has decided it.
Except with respect to vagueness or whether there's any evidence to support
right.
The...
I'm interested in finding out what your understanding is as to what the conduct was that violated 103D, that first sentence that Brother Stevens talked about. Is it recommending the services of the ACLU, which was using an associate of hers as a lawyer?
Your Honor, the construction that's placed on that rule in the state's brief does not require that there be any connection between her associates and the ACLU. If she assists or cooperates with the ACLU in any way, she cannot offer its services to anyone, recommend its services to anyone. That's the construction that's put on this rule in the state's brief at page 49, and it's the construction that I've understood to be put by the state throughout, and that's what makes it such an overbroad rule to totally prohibit a member attorney from recommending the services of the organization. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McLean, I take it you feel this case is very different from the Oralik case.
I don't think there's any question about that, Your Honor.
Mr. Cale?
You might tell me early in the game how you think the conduct involved here violated 103D, that first sentence, if that's your claim.
Yes, sir, Mr. Justice White. It is, of course, our claim that the conduct in this case did violate DR 2103D, and I think it's important to look at the South Carolina Supreme Court's...
Well, you can just tell me. How did it?
It violated the disciplinary rule because it recommended the services of the ACLU, which had as members of cooperating attorneys, both Ms. Smith's private law partners. One was a staff attorney for the ACLU, and the other one was a cooperating attorney who was, both of which were participants in the subsequent litigation that arose out of these events.
And you think then that she was aiding an organization to promote her services or an associate service?
Yes, sir.
And the associate was not a law partner, I take it. That's the
associate was not a law partner. What do you, of the firm?
Yes.
Yes, her. I don't quite understand what you
sharing,
mean by that.
They were sharing expenses and keeping their own fees. That's what the finding is.
Yes, sir. The court and counsel.
You say that makes that brings them within the definition of associates.
Yes, sir. I think it's very definite that they had established a firm and were portraying to the public that they were a firm and that they were partners in the pursuit of their legal practice.
Well, do they have to be partners to get within 103D? Or is
no, sir. It also provides
associates.
Yes, sir. This counsel and court today are required to perform the unpleasant task of examining the ethical conduct of a fellow member of the legal profession. Appellant Smith, who is a licensed attorney in the state of South Carolina, was found by the South Carolina Supreme Court to have violated its disciplinary rules and was publicly reprimanded for this conduct. The enforcement of disciplinary rules, while perhaps an unpleasant task, is a necessary one for the protection of the welfare of the public and for the protection of the administration of justice. For indeed, an attorney's conduct as an officer at the court does reflect upon the judicial system. This court has long recognized the right and indeed the necessity of the states to regulate the practice of law within its borders. The two disciplinary rules which the court found that Appellant Smith had violated were disciplinary rules 2103D5 and 2104A5 of the American Bar Association's Code of Professional Responsibility. This code was adopted in the state of South Carolina by the South Carolina Supreme Court in 1973. Both of these rules concern the solicitation of business by a lawyer. However, the incident case involves more than the mere recommendation by an attorney of his employment or the employment of his partners or associates. The incident case involves the question, can an attorney attempt to induce or persuade a prospective client to bring a lawsuit and to permit the attorney, his partner or associates, to handle the case? Because of the differing factual interpretations in this case, I would like to briefly refer to the record. It is undisputed that Mrs. Williams, who appellant saw as a client for the American Civil Liberties Union, had not requested legal assistance from Ms. Smith or from any other person. In July of 1973, a meeting was arranged by Appellant Smith and a Mr. Gary Allen for the purpose of Ms. Smith advising certain women about the sterilization performed upon them by their private physician. This meeting was attended by members of the press. Mrs. Williams had not requested this meeting and, in fact, did not know of the meeting until she was approached by Mr. Allen as she left the hospital where her child was critically ill and was not expected to live. Mr. Allen requested Mrs. Williams to accompany him to meet the appellant. Ms. Smith advised Mrs. Williams about her legal rights. They went into depth about the sterilization question. She told her of her legal rights and remedies, and she even advised her at that time that the American Civil Liberties Union could render legal services to Mrs. Williams. Mrs. Williams left the meeting after informing appellant that if she decided to bring a lawsuit, she would contact appellant. Mrs. Williams never contacted Ms. Smith to make any such request. It is the position of the state that the appellant's further attempt to secure Mrs. Williams as a client by writing the letter of August 30th, 1973, is not protected by the First Amendment and is clearly prohibited by the disciplinary rules in question. Certainly, when Mrs. Williams left the meeting, she was in a position to decide her own best interest about the lawsuit. To permit the conduct in this case would only encourage attorneys to be persistent with potential clients. The danger of permitting the conduct, I think, is well illustrated by the testimony of Mrs. Williams, which I'd like to quote to the court. She said, "I got tired of everybody aggravating me."
Where did we find that in the appendix?
That is at page 57 of the appendix. "Everyone was coming to ask me, wasn't I going to file a lawsuit? And after I had said 100 times I didn't want to sue, then I got the notion that maybe if I did sue, maybe they'd leave me alone. I'm tired of being bothered." This points up, I think, a very important reason for having rules against solicitation, in that people ought to be able to decide whether they want to bring a lawsuit or select an attorney without pressure and any type of inducement by an attorney.
Mr. Cale, may I just ask one question here? Supposing the letter had not been written by Ms. Smith, but rather had been written by the ACLU, would such a letter have been constitutionally protected?
Your Honor, we do not believe it would be.
I'm just wondering, that's not a distinction that you rely on with respect to the Button case, then? The fact
no,
that the letter is written by the lawyer rather than by the...
No, sir. Of course, the distinction here is that, of course, as a disciplinary action, we have ability to discipline attorneys. We do not have the ability to confront the organization.
Well, presumably, get an injunction against the layperson or something like that. What if she had just given advice at the first meeting and had not said, "We will represent you," or the ACLU will represent you, and then she went home, and a month later, the ACLU decided, yes, it would finance such a lawsuit, and then they had written this letter. Would it have been protected then?
Your Honor, I can only refer to the decision of the South Carolina Supreme Court. They did not, in their opinion, find any misconduct because of the first letter. It was a subsequent seeking of the client that they found was reprehensible conduct.
Well, if that's so, and if the ACLU did not decide to provide free legal services for this person until after the first meeting, how could the ACLU communicate that information to that person? Is there any way in the world they could do it without...
Your Honor, I don't think it's necessary that the organization state to the potential client that they desire to bring it. I think Mrs. Williams knew at the time she was advised...
Supposing the first meeting were a little more inconclusive. Assume the first meeting is legal advice about a potential lawsuit and nothing about financing or willingness to participate, and then the lawyer goes home. After that, the ACLU decides, yes, we would like to sponsor this litigation.
Your Honor,
can they constitutionally tell the potential client that fact?
Your Honor, under my reading of the disciplinary rules, they would not be able to communicate the letter, even if they had not advised her in the July meeting.
Is there any way, then there's just no way that information could be communicated to the potential client, that's what you're saying? The Constitution doesn't afford any protection to that particular...
Not through personal solicitation.
Would you say the same if the writer of the letter was an employee of the American Civil Liberties Union, a hired lawyer? On this a paid staff member?
Yes, sir. I do not believe that he would be able to convey to the organization.
You don't think that's covered by Button?
No, sir. Perhaps at the outset, we should deal with appellant's argument that the disciplinary rules in this case are overbroad. Of course, we contend that the activities on this record were not protected by the First Amendment. But even if the court should find that solicitation by attorneys is afforded some protection under the First Amendment, we would submit to the court that such would be commercial expression to which the overbreath doctrine applies weakly at all. As the court noted in Bates versus State of Arizona, commercial expression is not likely to be crushed by such restrictions, and we would urge the court not to apply overbreath to the case of solicitation by attorneys as they decline to apply it to professional advertising. The litigation which appellant sought to promote in this case was an action for, as she expressed it, money against Mrs. Williams' private physician. We maintain that this was private litigation, which the court in Button clearly recognized as being traditionally condemned. I would point out that last week this court considered another sterilization case in Stump versus Sparkman, in which a daughter had been sterilized at the request of her natural mother and sole parent. Regardless of whether one considers the mother's actions in that case to be right or wrong, it occurs to me that if we accept appellant's argument that an attorney has the right to persuade or induce potential clients to file suit, then an attorney in that case could, of course, persuade or induce the daughter to file suit against the mother. I could not think of any conduct which would be less desirable by an attorney.
Can you decide this case on the basis of how you feel about particular kinds of lawsuits? Doesn't there have to be some sort of general rule one way or the other?
Your Honor, I think it would be difficult to draw a disciplinary rule that distinguished between conduct on the basis of the type of lawsuit that was brought. The role of an attorney in this society should be to settle disputes and not assume the role of provoking such disputes. The court in Button clearly recognized the undesirability of stirring up litigation which interferes with established relationships, as in this particular case, the relationship between a private physician and his patient. I find it interesting to note appellant's argument.
Well, how about Rule 10b-5, for example, that certainly encourages litigation between an established relationship of a client and a stockbroker? Can you make that generalization that against a constitutional challenge that the state has a right to discourage stirring up litigation that questions or challenges an established relationship?
Your Honor, I think that you can if it's a private relationship. For example, as the court noted in NAACP versus Button, litigation which would sow family discord or litigation which interfered with private relationships. I wouldn't assume that the relationship between the stockbroker and his client would be such a private relationship as between a physician and his patient. I find it interesting to note appellant's argument that what she was trying to convey to Mrs. Williams in her August 30th letter was to bring action against government, as she maintains. But if you look at the letter, this was not what she told Mrs. Williams. She said, "The ACLU would like to file a lawsuit on your behalf for money against the doctor who performed the operation." The letter, I think, was clearly misleading to Mrs. Williams, who at the panel hearing stated that she had only been told by Ms. Appellant that the only thing that could be accomplished by the lawsuit was to get money. I feel that the letter of August 30th was clearly an inducement to Mrs. Williams with the prospect of receiving money to allow the American Civil Liberties Union to file suit for her.
Now, if the legal department of a union writes to one of its members recommending that the members start litigation with respect to something that's happened to them, would that be proscribed by these rules, or is it that the union isn't the kind of an organization that's covered by the rules?
Your Honor, I think the rules in question specifically have excluded the court's line of decision in the union cases, where collective activities to members to obtain access to the legal system has been protected. I think it's an important point here to note the difference in that Mrs. Williams was not a member of the organization. There was no protection of collective activities by the members, who I think in the court's decision in the union cases was always, it was always the grieved party that should obtain access to the court. I don't believe that the court ruled in the union cases that attorneys can participate in collective activities to obtain access to the courts. I think it was always from the standpoint of the aggrieved parties obtaining access to the court.
But the if a union were involved, I suppose its lawyers could make recommendations to its members.
Yes, sir, to its members.
But not to outsiders?
No, sir.
Wasn't there something in Justice Black's opinion to the effect that this was embraced within the services that the union members were receiving in exchange for their dues to have a lawyer experienced in these kinds of cases? Isn't there some hint of that?
I believe you're right, Your Honor. I think another important consideration that you have in this case, which justifies the prohibitions of solicitation, are the potential conflicts that arise with an organization that attempts to achieve organizational goals through litigation and their representation of non-members. Certainly, the interest of the organization and the non-member are not so identical, as the court noted in NAACP versus Button, that the potential conflicts of interest cannot arise. For example,
what rule would cover if there is one, a direct solicitation by the ACLU? Say the president of the ACLU, a non-lawyer, wrote the same letter to this lady. Would there be?
We could not prohibit a non-lawyer under the disciplinary rules from doing anything.
But is there a statute that prohibits that kind of solicitation?
There is a statute in South Carolina prohibiting solicitation by our
Would it cover that my example?
Your Honor, I cannot say for sure. I don't think there's ever been a prosecution that I know of under that criminal
statute.
But
if the organization uses a lawyer to solicit, it is covered under this rule.
Yes, sir. Lawyers' activities are, of course, prescribed under these rules.
But I take it you indicate there are other prohibitions about a non-lawyer soliciting business for lawyers.
We have a criminal statute in the state of South Carolina which prohibits solicitation.
What? Well, of course, solicitation has a variety of meanings.
Yes, sir.
Does it prohibit...
solicitation of legal business, excuse me, sir.
By a non-lawyer.
Yes, sir. Right.
Mr. Cale, the distinction between members and non-members, the Button case, if I remember, involved solicitation of or litigation of non-members of the NAACP, didn't it?
Yes, sir. I believe that is correct. However, if you look at the case in NAACP versus Button, you will note that the normal way that the NAACP obtained clients was not through solicitation, but for requests directly by the client to the NAACP, except in desegregation cases. And in desegregation cases, the NAACP undertook a program in order to implement the court's decisions in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 and subsequent to tear
How's
down...
How is that different from an ACL program to put an end to sterilization?
Well, Your Honor, we would maintain that the difference being that the action in desegregation cases were actions against government. Here, as the Fourth Circuit noted in the subsequent litigation that came out of
they ultimately found no state action, but at the time of the what we're describing as a solicitation, it was the view of the ACLU and its attorneys that there was a valid state action theory that they could proceed on, wasn't it?
Your Honor,
and they did file a 1983 case.
I think you would have to look at the view in as far as this disciplinary action, which was of the appellant at the time she wrote the letter. In the letter, she said, we would like to file an action for money
against the doctor on the theory that the doctor is acting under color of state law.
If we have to go one step farther and say, well, what happened in subsequent litigation, didn't they envision an action against government, then I think you would have to take it maybe one step further and say that, well, may we have to wait to the conclusion of the litigation to determine whether this was, in fact, action against government. My point, as far as this particular action, I do not believe it was the type of action which the court attempted to carve out any type of exception, no more so than, for example, if an individual had brought a suit and named the state of South Carolina as a defendant under the Motor Vehicle Tort Claim Act.
But why not? I really don't quite get your theory. Is it because it ended up with a finding that there was no state action? Or is it because it was a frivolous state action claim? Or there's a difference between sterilization and segregation? Precisely what is the difference between this and the kind of litigation involved in Button?
Your Honor, the difference is that, of course, I think it interfered with a private relationship, that being the relationship.
Well, I imagine that some of the litigation that grew out of the NAACP activities interfered with quite a few private relationships.
Yes, sir, but not the established type of relationship that you have between a doctor and his patient. Moreover, the type of litigation that they had in Button did not, as the court recognized, have any financial benefit to the organization, which, of course, it has in this particular case through the possibility of court award of attorney.
Well, that doesn't turn on the kind of litigation, then. That turns
on
the kind of compensation.
Well, Mr. Kale, with all respect to my colleagues and many here in the room, what is the difference for constitutional purposes between the relationship between a doctor and his patient or a lawyer and his client and the relationship between the Avon lady and the person she calls on to sell cosmetics to?
Well, of course, the Avon lady and her client is a purely commercial type of relationship.
Yeah, ordinarily I would think of her as a customer rather than a client.
Yes, sir. I think it's the professionalism that is involved in the particular relationship of a patient and his doctor, which requires a certain amount of trust. And if lawsuits are prescribed, I think that very seriously this will interfere with the type of professional relationship.
So you say it heightens the state's interest when you have this kind of professional relationship?
Yes, sir.
Well, would the NAACP today violate this rule or the lawyers for the NAACP, the paid staff lawyers for NAACP, if they wrote non-members of the NAACP suggesting litigation to cure some situation that the NAACP thinks should be cured?
Your Honor, I do not believe that the court intended in NAACP versus Button to give the NAACP a complete blanket exemption
from
soliciting clients.
Well, what is your answer? Is it yes?
Yes, sir. I think it very well could be.
Well, I didn't. Do you think it would or not?
Well, what was the specific litigation they were soliciting?
A school suit. Say a school suit.
Oh, not a school suit, no, sir. I think.
What do you mean, not a school suit?
You mean for desegregation? Are you?
Yes, and it wants to get specific clients to specific individuals to bring the suit, and they will represent them.
Then I think you're, of course, getting very almost on point on a factual situation in NAACP versus Button.
Even though the paid lawyer for the NAACP is writing a letter soliciting business or soliciting a lawsuit, and the NAACP will profit from an attorney's fee.
Well, Your Honor, of course, the type of conduct that was involved in the case before the court in 1963, which the court, I think, very closely stated what they were limiting their decision to the record on the court.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock, counsel. Thank you.
You may resume, Mr. Cale.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, at this point, I think I would like to make some brief summary remarks and close my argument. And I would like to urge the court to consider, in the facts of this case, that the prospective client, Mrs. Williams, had been advised prior to the August letter from Appellant Smith of her legal rights and remedies and the availability of the ACLU to represent her. Appellant Smith, in her testimony before the grievance committee, testified that in her letter she was seeking members of the plaintiff class so that the American Civil Liberties Union could have clients. I would submit that the First Amendment was not intended to protect or afford the attorney a right to secure the client. We would respectfully request that this court consider these facts and affirm the decision of the South Carolina Supreme Court. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.